So what do doctors really think about healthcare costs?
Does debriding wounds help?
Who should be screened with an echocardiogram?
And clearing the smoke on menthol cigarettes.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 2nd, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I would like to start with this proclamation by the FDA that menthol cigarettes are actually more troublesome for people who are trying to quit smoking.
This is a 153-page report looking at the preliminary scientific evaluation of the possible health effects of menthol versus non-menthol cigarettes. So, Elizabeth, I'm going to serve this up as if you're the consumer and you were going to ask the expert about menthol cigarettes, what questions would you be interested in having answered?
I would ask, what is the ingredient or ingredients in menthol cigarettes that give them that particular taste or sensation people have when they smoke them? And what is it that makes them so troublesome to quit?
Well, in fact, it is the menthol. And it's that menthol which somewhat alters or deadens the sensation. It takes away some of the acid of the smoke. And as a result, it makes it more appealing. For this reason, they're thought to be more addictive. People that initiate smoking with menthol cigarettes are more likely to have long-term cigarette use than those that smoke non-mentholated cigarettes.
Well, I guess I have to wonder whose brainwave was it to begin with to add menthol to cigarettes, and is there something we can do to get it removed?
I don't have that information about who was the brainchild that thought of this, but what I can tell you is the cigarette companies have done a terrific job of advertising it and promoting it. Menthol cigarettes have been advertised heavily to youth. They've done it for minorities as well. You might ask, well, are they actually more dangerous? Well, the answer is no. They're no more toxic than non-mentholated in terms of the health problems they cause.
Naturally, I'm going to say, isn't there something we can do based on this data to say that mentholated cigarettes ought to be outlawed?
In fact, the FDA Tobacco Products Scientific Advisory Committee in 2011 voted on its final report to actually remove menthol cigarettes from the marketplace. So this is a review that will hopefully spur that process.
Well, we're going to hope that that actually works and that one day we actually outlaw cigarettes in their entirety. Let's turn now to this recurrent idea of who ought to be given an echocardiogram to assess their heart disease risk. That's at JAMA Internal Medicine.
The hypothesis is that if you could identify what's known as structural heart disease in people that don't have any symptoms, valve issues or hearts that are not squeezing or relaxing appropriately, that you could somehow modify that disease very early with some treatment and the outcome would be better. The nice thing about an echocardiogram, for our listeners that don't know, I think most people have seen a picture of a sonogram of a baby. We do a sonogram of the heart. We call it an echocardiogram. It doesn't involve any radiation. It causes no risk to the patient. The only downside is it costs money. The question is, if you apply it to a healthy population without symptoms, will it actually improve their outcome? So this was a study conducted in Norway where they took almost 7,000 middle-aged participants and they randomized them to receive an echocardiogram. The other 3,600 patients were the control group, and they followed them for 15 years. 27% in the screening group died, 28% in the control group died. There was no significant difference between the groups with regard to any cardiac issue. So in essence, the echo screening really did not improve their survival.
So this, of course, underpins other results we've reported from other studies on the value of screening EKGs in asymptomatic people.
The difference between EKGs and echoes is primarily the cost. Unless you've got a specific reason for doing it, if you're just doing it for screening purposes, it's really not beneficial.
And I would add that if you're part of the worried well, which sometimes I'm one of those people, I would say maybe you just ought to ante up and pay for it yourself if you really want to have an echocardiogram.
I hope there are listeners that fall in that category. I had a patient I was seeing a couple of weeks ago where I said, you have no heart disease. And they said, well, can't we do a test just to be absolutely certain? Can I have an echo? Because my neighbor had one. This would suggest that it's really not beneficial. And you're right. Maybe if we paid for it out of our pocket, we'd be a little bit more judicious about when we wanted one.
Okay, let's turn now to, while we're talking about these kinds of costs, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, physician attitudes toward healthcare costs.
I found this to be a fascinating study, and this is one I wanted to include for our listeners. What the authors did, they took a survey that was mailed to almost 4,000 U.S. physicians, randomly selected from the American Medical Association master file. And they ask about different cost containment strategies, ask about what's called a cost consciousness scale, trying to figure out what physicians actually think about controlling healthcare costs. Part of it was interesting, part of it was disappointing. What do you want to hear first?
I'd like to have the bad news first. I'd like to end on a positive note.
Well, here's what was disappointing. Most believe that controlling healthcare costs was the responsibility primarily of lawyers, 60%, health insurance companies, 59%, hospitals and health systems, 56%, pharmaceuticals and device manufacturers, 56%, patients, 52%, and practicing physicians, 36%. What this tells me is that we're putting the blame, we're sharing it, but we think that everybody else, other than physicians, carry a larger responsibility. So I found that a little disappointing.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Come on. We know that you guys are like ordering way too much stuff. We've already established that.
It is. And what the physicians would say is, well, we're doing that because the patients want it. You have to check certain boxes that I did these tests or you don't meet these certain milestones. Oftentimes they're done to avoid medical legal issues as well. So the physicians would say, you know, we'd love to stop doing that, but other people are forcing our hand. Regardless of who we're blaming, what I thought was the thing that was quite positive about it is the vast majority of physicians agreed that containing healthcare costs was essential. And that was about 88%. Now, they were less enthusiastic about going from a fee-for-service payment system to a pure salary. They were really unenthusiastic about payments that were tied to patient outcome. And that I can understand because we can do a lot of things. We can encourage patients, we can prescribe, we can use the right tests, but ultimately I can't be responsible for whether the patient follows advice. So I can understand why physicians would be reluctant to tie their reimbursement to how a patient is actually doing.
Very fascinating. Well, a recent study here from our fine institution showed that when physicians were apprised of the cost of tests, they scrutinized the necessity for it lots more closely. So that's good news too.
It is.
Okay. Finally then, let's look at this idea of wound debridement, removing dead tissue from it and seeing how that impacts on ultimate wound health, I guess, and time of healing. That's in JAMA Dermatology.
For dermatologists and surgeons that do this all the time, they understand how important it can be for helping a wound to heal. When you're actually the recipient, it seems barbaric. I mean, why would you take someone that has a wound and purposely rough it up or debride it or debride it? And the reason for that is it could potentially increase healing. And that's what this study addressed. It's a retrospective cohort study of almost 313,000 wounds. Some of these wounds were due to diabetic foot ulcers, venous leg ulcers, pressure ulcers, some from trauma. And these wounds were cared for differently. Some had debridement done multiple times during a week, some once a week, some once every 2 weeks, really some not at all. And they followed wound healing. And what they discovered was that 71% of the wounds healed, frequent debridement heal wounds in a much shorter time. For an individual that had a diabetic foot ulcer, if debridement was done weekly, the wound healed in 21 days. If it was done once every couple weeks, it took 64 to 76 days to heal. Same thing for traumatic wounds. If it was debrided appropriately, the time to heal was 14 days. If it was done once every couple weeks or longer, it took 42 to 49 days to heal. So good evidence that what we're doing, although it looks barbaric, it's sometimes uncomfortable for the patient, helps to foster wound healing.
The other issue that I would have to mention here is, again, to cite research that's been carried on here at Hopkinson and other places. The question is, what's the wound the result of? And a very large number of these wounds are the result of venous ulcers. And in that case, debridement by itself is insufficient frequently. What's needed is some other types of therapies that could ultimately result in wound healing. And then the other thing is that debridement also results in less significant scarring, at least as far as I can tell.
Yeah, apparently if you don't debride the wound, as it begins to heal, it creates an inflammatory response, and there are inhibitors that prevent the wound from healing appropriately. And as a result, there's a much bigger scar.
So if people are told that they're going to get their scabs removed and it might be a little bit uncomfortable, it should probably be something that they say, well, all right, I'll tolerate it because I think my outcome will be better.
And on the flip side, if the wound's not being debrided, it's going to take longer to heal. You really ought to ask that it be performed.
Okay. So this week, I guess what I will talk about will be, what do you think, Rick?
put the physicians' views on controlling healthcare costs out there. I think both physicians and non-physicians would be interested in that.
Excellent. So that's what I'll write about on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And Elizabeth, we've just done our 400th podcast. What a pleasure. To all our listeners, y'all live well.